This morning's class has been assigned to be an introduction to the Apostle Peter. An introduction to the Apostle Peter. I'd like to begin by asking you, how many lists of the apostles are there in the New Testament? How many lists of the apostles are there in the New Testament? I think I heard it.
Three.
Three is close. There's two for sure, and three is close. I see four. Thank you, Alan. Four is right. What books of the New Testament are those lists in? What four different books? Correct. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Acts. What name is first in all four lists? The Apostle Peter, yes. Just to get a sense of how dominant he is, the only person in the gospel record who's mentioned more than Peter is Jesus himself. The Lord spoke more often to Peter than to any of his other disciples. No disciple was so pointedly and directly reproved by the Lord as Peter. No disciple ventures to reprove the Lord except Peter. No disciple was ever so boldly confessed and outspokenly acknowledged and encouraged as Peter was. No one ever intruded and interfered and tempted the Lord as repeatedly as Peter did. The Lord spoke words of approval and blessing to Peter, the like of which he never spoke to anybody else. And at the same time, almost in the same breath, he said harsher things to Peter than he ever said to any of the 12 except Judas. We know enough about Peter that as we read about him, all of his humanness comes through. Peter was eager, aggressive, and outspoken. Somebody called him the apostle with the foot-shaped mouth. In the first 12 chapters of Acts, again, the main character is Peter. He's the driving force. And Jesus, in Matthew chapter 10, we're told, particularly and specifically, chose Peter. There's nothing in him that's perfect. There's nothing that's all complete. He's not but a big beginning from his head to the soles of his feet. That's what Peter was when we first meet him, a big beginning. He stands out as the spokesman of the 12. He asks the meaning of a difficult saying in Matthew 15. He asks how often he must forgive in Matthew 18. He asks what is to be the reward of those who have left all and followed Christ in Matthew 19. He asks about the fig tree and why it had withered in Mark 11. He asks about the approaching end of things in Mark 13. It was to Peter that the Jews came and asked if Jesus paid his taxes in Matthew 17. It was Peter who answered when Jesus asked who had touched him in the crowd. It was Peter who questioned the risen Christ in John 21. Peter was always verbalizing. He was always initiating dialogue. Peter wanted to know, and Peter made things happen. Now, the man whom the Lord chose was named Simon. He was the son of a man named Jonas or John. He was a fisherman by trade. He had a brother named Andrew. They first lived in Bethsaida and then in Capernaum later. Peter was married and had a mother-in-law. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9 that he had the right to lead about a wife like Peter did. Peter's wife may have been with him a lot of the time. Simon was a common name. There were at least seven Simons in the gospel accounts. Can you tell me who those seven Simons were? Cephas? Did you say Simon the Zealot, Barbara? Oh, okay. Well, he's not in the gospels, but he is in the book of Acts. That's right next door. Simon the Tanner is in the book of Acts as well. So there's at least a couple more Simons there. But I was just thinking in the gospel accounts, we have two among the apostles, Simon Peter and Simon the Zealot. Who else do we have? Simon Bar-Jonah, is that what you said? That's the same as Simon Peter or Cephas. Yes, different name for him. When he was born, that was his name, Simon Bar-Jonah. What other Simons do we have in the Gospels? Oh, Simeon, yeah, when Jesus was born. That's fine. Well, Jesus, for instance, had a half-brother named Simon, right? So that's one. What was Judas Iscariot's father's name? Simon. Yes. Good guess. Also, Jesus had a meal at the home of a man in Bethany by the name of Simon the leper. And another Simon named, he was Simon the Pharisee. He hosted a similar meal for Jesus in Luke 7. One more, the man who was conscripted to carry Jesus' cross partway to Calvary, Simon of Cyrene. So there's lots of Simons, but this Simon that we're talking about today, as has been pointed out, his full name at birth was Simon Bar-Jonah. Matthew 16, 17, Jesus called him that, just being Simon, son of Jonah. His father's name was John, sometimes rendered as Jonas or Jonah. And we don't know anything more about his parents than that. But the Lord gave him another name. Luke chapter 6, verse 14 says, Simon, whom he also named Peter. Peter is Greek. Cephas is Aramaic, but they're the same name in two different languages. They mean a stone or a rock. Jesus didn't give him a new name to replace the old one. He also named him Peter. He didn't take away the name Simon. Still used the name Simon, but he also named him Peter. Sometimes he was known as Simon, sometimes as Peter, sometimes as Simon Peter. Peter is sort of a nickname. Peter is the Greek word, Petros is the Greek word for rock. By nature, Simon was brash, he was vacillating, he was undependable. Perhaps he was a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways, as James might have put it. Jesus gave him a nickname that was a perpetual reminder of what he ought to be. Tommy Lasorda was the manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers. Years ago, they brought a skinny young pitcher into their minor league system. He had an extraordinarily powerful and accurate arm. But he was timid in his personality. He was frightened by nature. Tommy Lasorda was convinced that this young pitcher had the potential to be one of the best, but he could see that he needed to be fiercer. He needed to be more competitive and lose the timidity. So Tommy Lasorda gave him a nickname that was exactly the opposite of his personality. He called him Bulldog. Over the years, that's exactly what Oral Hershiser became. One of the most tenacious competitors that ever took a major league mound. It's not COVID, don't worry about it. I think something must have bloomed. It happens every early May if I'm in Missouri. Anyway, with Oral Hershiser, this nickname Bulldog became a perpetual reminder of what he ought to be, and eventually it shaped his whole attitude. So this man Simon we're talking about today, and I wish I knew his age. Wouldn't it be great if we had a full biography of Simon Peter, like 700 pages long, so we could know every little thing about him? It'd be so great. But we only have these little details. The good thing is the details we have are the details the Lord wanted us to have. So I don't know his name, but I do know that he was impetuous, impulsive, he was overeager, and he needed to become like a rock. That's why Jesus called him that. There seem to be a couple of different contexts in the New Testament in which he is called Simon. One is his secular identity. When we're talking about his general life in the world, people refer to him as Simon. When Scripture refers to his house, for instance, and by the way, we have found Simon Peter's house. It's right down by the Sea of Galilee in Capernaum. You can go there and visit. When Scripture refers to his house, it's usually Simon's house. And I could give you the references for these, but I doubt that you want them. Cornelius in the 10th chapter of Acts was directed by the angel to send down to get Simon. His mother-in-law is always Simon's wife's mother. Luke 5:3 talks about Simon's boat. And in verse 10, it says that James and John were partners in the fishing enterprise with Simon. So his work, his home, his family life, these are Simon's things. The second context in which he's called Simon is when he's acting or thinking like his old self. When he's thinking, acting, or talking like his old self, he gets called by his old name. In the context of fishing, in Luke chapter 5, verse 5, Jesus says, Simon, put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch. And Peter says, Master, we've worked all night and we've caught nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I'll let down the nets. That's Simon, the fisherman, talking. He's reluctant and he's skeptical. But he obeys. And as he obeys and they catch enough fish to fill both boats, his eyes are open to who Jesus really is. And Luke then begins to use his new name. In verse 8, when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees saying, Depart from me, O Lord, for I am a sinful man. In Luke 22:31, Jesus again says, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. So it's not just Simon, it's Simon, Simon. That repetition is filled with meaning, I think. I can remember when I was a boy, my dad would look at me sometime and shake his head and say, Son, son. So disappointed. And I think the same thing is true here. Later on in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Peter should have been watching and praying with Jesus, he fell asleep. When Jesus found them sleeping, he said to Peter, Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. That's Mark chapter 14, verses 37 and 38. So usually when Peter needed admonition, when he needed rebuke, Jesus referred to him as Simon. In fact, it must have reached a point where when the Lord said Simon, Peter just cringed. Oh, come on. Please call me Rock. Thanks, Matt. I should have told you ahead of time that doesn't help, but your thought's good. I appreciate it. I hate drinking in front of an audience because it makes everybody thirsty. So I go down here. Thank you very much. Beautiful thought. Appreciate it. Simon must have been thinking, please call me Rock. And the Lord might have replied, well, I'll call you Rock when you act like a rock. The apostle John knew Peter very, very well. They were close friends. They were business associates for a long, long time. And they were neighbors. You don't usually know anybody much better than that. In the Gospel of John, John refers to his friend 15 times as Simon Peter. John's personality was much different from Peter. I'm not sure John ever fully understood Peter, so he almost always calls him Simon Peter. He just puts them both in there because he's so used to, or at least the reason I think is because he's so used to seeing Peter show both sides of his personality every day. He sees both sides of Peter constantly. So he just puts both names together and lets it go at that. In fact, Simon Peter calls himself Simon Peter in the intro to his second epistle, last thing we have that he ever wrote. Simon Peter, a bondservant and apostle of Jesus Christ, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 1. So in effect, Peter took Jesus' nickname for him and made it his surname. And we have this kind of indication in Acts chapter 10, verse 32. After the resurrection, Jesus instructed his disciples to return to Galilee where he would appear to them. Simon Peter apparently got tired of waiting, so he announced he was going back to fishing in John 21, verse 3. And the others followed him. They got into a boat, fished all night, and caught nothing. Jesus met them on the shore the following morning. He prepared breakfast for them, and the purpose of this breakfast meeting seems to have been the restoration of Peter, because Peter had sinned egregiously by denying Christ with curses on the night that the Lord was betrayed. So three times on this occasion, Jesus then addressed him as Simon. Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? It's like Bobby Freeman's song, Do You Love Me? That repetition is important. And this was the last time that Jesus ever had to call him Simon, at least as far as we know. A few weeks later on Pentecost, Peter and the rest of the apostles were filled with the Holy Spirit. And on that occasion, it was Peter the Rock who stood up and preached. So we find a man who is exactly like most of us. He's both carnal and spiritual. He succumbed to the flesh sometimes, and he functioned in the spirit other times. He was sinful sometimes, and other times he behaved in a way that a righteous man ought to. Back when I had the responsibility for this congregation, we were looking for permanent leadership. And I arranged a dinner for six on the subject of leadership. And the very first discussion question I gave you on that subject was that age-old debate prompter, are leaders born or made? Are leaders born or made? I think Peter is a strong argument for the belief that leaders are born with certain innate gifts, but must also be shaped into true helpful leaders. Peter had the God-given fabric of leadership woven into his personality from the beginning. God put it there. He had the right raw material. He was not happy to remain ignorant about what he didn't understand. He was insatiably curious and hungry to find answers. In the gospel account, Peter asked more questions than all of the other apostles combined. He always wanted to understand things better. He had the drive, the ambition, the energy to take the initiative. So he not only asked questions, but he's usually the first one to answer questions that were posed by Jesus. Who do you say that I am? Jesus asked. Peter says immediately, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. I think the others were still processing the question. But Peter was bold, and Peter was decisive. In the Garden of Gethsemane, when Roman soldiers came from Fort Antonia to arrest Jesus, there was a great multitude armed with swords and staves. A typical Roman cohort consisted of 600 soldiers, and in all likelihood, there were hundreds of battle-ready Roman troops in and around the Garden of Gethsemane that night. But without hesitating, Peter pulled his sword and took a swing at the head of Malchus, the high priest's servant. The high priest was the one who was initiating and ordering the arrest, so his entourage would have been right at the front of the rest. Malchus ducked, so only his ear got chopped off. Jesus touched the ear and healed him, and told Peter to put up his sword. But just think about that incident for a moment. There are maybe hundreds of Roman soldiers there. What does Peter think he's going to do? He's going to behead them all one by one? Sometimes Peter's passion for taking the initiative overlooked the obvious big picture reality. But with all of his brashness, Peter had the raw material to make a leader from. And it's better to work with a man like that than to try to motivate somebody who's always passive and hesitant. It's easier to tone down a fanatic than it is to resurrect a corpse. And some people have to be dragged tediously in any forward direction. Not Peter. He always wanted to move ahead. He always wanted to know what he didn't know. He always wanted to understand what he didn't understand. Jesus came to the disciples one night in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, walking on the water in the midst of a violent storm. And who, out of all the disciples, jumped out of the boat? The other disciples wondered if they were seeing a ghost. Peter says, Lord, if it's you, bid me to come to you on the water. And Jesus says, come. Before anybody knew it, Peter was out of the boat, walking on the water. This is serious involvement. When he started thinking about the danger, then he started to sink. But we've got to give Peter credit for having the faith to leave the boat in the first place. Not everybody did that. Similarly, although Peter denied Christ, we need to keep in mind that he and one other disciple, probably John, were the only ones who followed Jesus to the high priest's house to see what would become of him. John 18, verse 15. And in the courtyard of the high priest's house, Peter was the only one close enough for Jesus to turn and look him in the eyes when the rooster crowed. Luke 22, 61. Long after the other disciples had forsaken Christ and fled in fear for their lives, Peter was virtually alone in a position where such a temptation could snare him to deny the Lord. Because despite his fear and his weakness, he just couldn't abandon the Lord completely. He tried to stay as close to the Lord as he could get and still maintain some semblance of safety himself. Peter had an insatiable curiosity. He had a willingness to take the initiative. He had a passion to be personally involved. That was the raw material. So Jesus poured into Peter's life the right experiences to shape and temper that raw material. Sometimes we have our biggest defeats right after our greatest victories. Right after Jesus commended Peter for his great confession in Matthew 16, 16. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus, this was the moment Jesus had been waiting for because he needed to tell them what was going to happen. First, he had to be identified. It wasn't any good for them to know that he was going to be killed if they didn't know it was the Son of God dying. So the instant that Peter identifies Jesus, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God, then Jesus gives Peter the harshest rebuke ever recorded of an apostle in the New Testament. At one moment, he's calling Peter blessed, and he's promising him the keys of the kingdom. And the next minute, he's calling Peter Satan and saying, get behind me, which means get out of my way. This happened because right after this identification, Jesus then told what was going to happen next. I've got to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes. I'm going to be killed. Didn't matter if he was killed if they didn't know it was the Son of God dying, but once they knew his identity for sure, then Jesus tells that he's going to be killed and Peter will not accept it. Peter rebuked the Lord, saying, Lord, this is not going to happen to you, implying I'm not going to let it happen to you. I'm going to control the situation. I'll chop off heads first. It's not going to happen to you. And Peter's sentiment is totally understandable. But he didn't understand the plan of God. Out of love for the Lord, he became the tempter of the Lord. He tempted Jesus to evade the cross. One of the very temptations that Satan himself gave Jesus at the beginning of his ministry in the wilderness. Without realizing it, Peter was trying to dissuade Jesus from the very thing he came to earth to do. As usual, he was speaking when he ought to have been listening and learning. Jesus said, Peter, you're an offense to me. Because you're not mindful of the things of God, you're looking at all of this from a purely human standpoint. Peter had just learned in the Lord's commendation of him that God would reveal truth to him as he submitted his mind to the truth. But now he also learns that he was vulnerable to Satan and that Satan could fill his mouth just as the Lord could fill it. On the night of Jesus' arrest, Peter learned the hard way that he was humanly weak and could not trust his own resolve. All of his boasting promises, all of his earnest internal resolutions didn't keep him from falling. After declaring in front of everybody that he would never deny Christ, he denied him anyway and punctuated his denials with passionate curses. What was happening? Satan was sifting him as wheat. And Peter learned how much chaff and how little substance there really was in him. He learned how watchful and he learned how careful he must be to rely only on the strength of the Lord. He also learned, though, that in spite of his spiritual weaknesses, the Lord still wanted to use him. The Lord wasn't casting him aside. The Lord still wanted him. Peter learned by experience, and sometimes the experiences were bitter, distressing, humiliating, painful. Other times, though, they were encouraging, uplifting, perfectly glorious, like when the time Peter and James and John saw Christ's divine brilliance on the Mount of Transfiguration. Either way, Peter made the most of his experiences. He gleaned lessons that later helped him help the church. One of Peter's problems was that he was inclined to try to take control of every situation. So the Lord taught him submission. In Matthew 17, tax collectors were in town to collect the annual 2 drachma half-shekel tax from each person 20 years of old and older. This was not a tax paid to Rome. This was a tax paid for the upkeep of the temple. And it was prescribed in Exodus chapter 30, verses 11 through 16. So it was a very old concept. Long before there was a temple, there was a temple tax, or what later was sort of made into the temple tax. We find that in 2 Chronicles 24, verse 9. This tax was equal to 2 days' wages, so it was no insignificant amount when it came to purchasing power. Those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the temple tax?" And Peter said, yes, he pays his taxes. But this posed a problem in Peter's mind. And Peter was thinking about this, and as the incarnate Son of God, Jesus was knowledgeable of what Peter was thinking. Was Jesus, as God's Son, morally obligated to pay the temple tax? Jesus could see the dilemma Peter was having, and so he asked him, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take taxes, from their sons or from strangers?" Peter said, "From strangers." He said, "From strangers, because kings don't tax their own children." So Jesus drew the conclusion for Peter, "Then are the sons free." Jesus had heavenly authority to opt out of the temple tax if he chose. But if he did that, it would send the wrong message as far as earthly authority is concerned. And so it's better to submit and just pay the tax and thereby avoid a situation which most people will not understand. So although Jesus was not technically obligated to pay the temple tax, he said, "Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, and take the fish that comes up first. Open its mouth, you'll find a piece of money. Take that, give it to them for me and you." Very interesting story. Most of you are local, so you know about Lake of the Woods over at Swope Park. Every few years, they drain that lake to dredge it out. It's filled up with silt. But every time they drain the Lake of the Woods, they find several cars that were stolen and joyridden in and then put into the lake to remove evidence. And often when a lake like that is drained, when it dries out a little bit, you'll find people with metal detectors down there just finding handfuls of coins that fall out of people's pockets when they swim. And there's really nothing unusual about a fish striking at a shiny object that's falling through the water. They do it all the time. So it's not all that unusual to for drachma, just exactly enough to pay the temple tax for 2. So by this process, the Lord taught Peter to submit willingly, taught him to pay his taxes, and that the Lord was going to pay his, even though he really, technically, wouldn't have had to and could have argued in a winning way that he wouldn't have to. To teach people to submit, you have to be an example of submission yourself. Sometimes a leader must submit even when there might seem to be good arguments against submitting in a given situation. And years later, the Apostle Peter would write in 1 Peter 2, verses 13 through 18, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or to governors, for this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men." This was the same lesson that Peter learned from Jesus. And he writes it down to pass it on to us. Don't use your freedom as a covering for evil. See yourself as the Lord's slave. Learning to submit was not an easy lesson for a natural leader. But Peter learned it, and he learned restraint. The night in the garden when Jesus said, "Peter, put up your sword," must have been hard to take in front of a whole horde of enemies. But Peter learned from what he saw that night. Later he would write, "Christ suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow in his steps," 1 Peter 2:21 through 23. "Who did no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, reviled not in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously." How different that writing is from the man who grabbed his sword to whack his way through the opposers. Peter learned restraint from the Lord. He learned humility from the Lord. Jesus said, "All of you will be made to stumble this night because of me." Matthew 26:31. Peter said, "Even if everybody else stumbles because of you, I will never be made to stumble. Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death." But everybody knows that Peter did deny Christ multiple times, just as Jesus had warned. Peter's shame and disgrace at having dishonored Christ so flagrantly were only magnified by the fact that he had boasted so stubbornly that he wouldn't do it. And the Lord used this to make Peter humble. When he wrote his first epistle, he said, "Be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time." 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 5 and 6. Now, in those days, the roads were always either muddy or dusty. So everybody's feet were always dirty, constantly. And when you went to a house for a meal, there was usually a servant whose job it was to wash the guest's feet. This was one of the least desirable jobs. And at the Last Supper in the upper room, there apparently had been no provision made for such a servant. So as everybody knows, Jesus washed his disciples' feet. But when he got to Peter, Peter says, "Lord, you shall never wash my feet." Peter was the master of the absolute statement. "I'll never deny you. You'll never wash my feet." It's always one way or the other, all or nothing with Peter. Very little nuance. But Jesus says, "If I don't wash you, you have no part with me." John 13:8. So Peter's answer, again, is typical of his unbridled wholeheartedness. "Lord, not my feet only, but my hands and my head also." In other words, wash all of me. There was never any middle ground with Peter. It was always all or nothing. But Jesus assured him that in spiritual terms, he was completely clean. After Judas left that night, Jesus told the other 11, "A new commandment I give you, that you love one another even as I have loved you. By this will all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another." Verses 35 and 36, 34 and 35 of John 13. Peter learned to love, and it became one of the hallmarks of his teaching. In 1 Peter 4:8, he wrote, "Above all things, have fervent love for one another, for love will cover up a multitude of sins." I've mentioned that Jesus told Peter that the devil has asked for you that he may sift you like wheat. Luke 22:31. We might have expected Peter to hear these words from Jesus, that Jesus might have been expected to say, "Satan wants you to sift you like wheat, but I'm not going to let him do that." You might expect that. But Jesus did not say that. In fact, he essentially let Peter know that he had given Satan the permission that he sought for. He was going to allow the devil to put Peter to the test, just as had happened in the case of Job in the Old Testament. In essence, the Lord is saying, "Peter, I'm going to let Satan toss you to the wind until there's nothing left but the reality of your faith." But he did tell him, "I have prayed for you that your faith not fail. And when you've returned to me, strengthen your brethren." That was the intent all along, to make out of Peter somebody who could really help the church. "When you've returned to me, strengthen your brethren." That's verse 32 again. Peter needed to learn compassion through his own ordeal so that when it was over, he could strengthen others in their ordeals. After being sifted, Peter was well equipped to empathize with other people's weaknesses. In 1 Peter 5:8, he wrote, "Be sober, be vigilant, for your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brothers in the world. May the God of all grace, who called us to eternal glory by Jesus Christ, after you have suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you." Peter had been to the bottom. He'd made an absolute fool of himself, and his own weakness had been thrown in his face. But he had been perfected, established, strengthened, and settled. And as usual here, he's writing out of his own experience. Finally, Peter had to learn courage. Not the impetuous kind, but he needed to learn the intrepid willingness to stick with the Lord no matter what, just as all of us need to learn. In John 21:18, the Lord said to him, "When you were young, you girded yourself, you walked where you wanted to. But when you're old, you will stretch out your hands and somebody else is going to gird you and carry you where you do not wish to go." And John, by inspiration, tells us that Peter spoke this, signifying by what death Peter would glorify God. John 21:19. The price of preaching the gospel was death for Peter. When he saw the risen Christ and he knew that Christ had conquered death, he knew that whatever earthly trials came his way were merely temporary because Christ had conquered death. So later he wrote in 1 Peter 1 about the inheritance that's incorruptible and undefiled and that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you. Here is a man who gradually changed from Simon into rock. He learned submission, restraint, humility, love, compassion, courage. He preached at Pentecost and 3,000 were saved. He and John healed a lame man. People were healed in Peter's very shadow. He raised Dorcas from the dead. He introduced the gospel to the Gentiles. He wrote two epistles in which he featured every single character lesson he had learned from the Lord. Was he perfect? No. In Galatians 2, old as he'd gotten and mature as he supposedly was, he still compromised and behaved like a hypocrite in the matter of the Judaizing teachers. Paul rebuked him, and to Peter's credit, he accepted Paul's correction. And when the error of the Judaizers was confronted in the council at Jerusalem, Peter spoke up first in defense of the gospel and introduced the argument that won the day. Acts 15:7 through 14. Jesus told Peter that he would die as a martyr. Scripture does not record the death of Peter, but the records of the early church, and these are very old traditions, they indicate that Peter was crucified. Eusebius cites the testimony of Clement, who says that before Peter was crucified, he was forced to watch the crucifixion of his wife. That'd be worse than the crucifixion of yourself, wouldn't it? Forced to watch the crucifixion of his wife. And Clement says that as Peter watched his wife being led to her death, he called out to her by name, saying, "Remember the Lord, remember the Lord." He knew that's what she needed to hear at that moment of trial. And when it was Peter's turn to die, we're told that he pleaded to be crucified upside down, because he wasn't worthy to die as his Lord had died. So according to the tradition, he was nailed to a cross head downward. And I think that Peter would probably want us to conclude this introduction to him today the way he concluded his last epistle, the final words of his last epistle. Grow in grace and knowledge of the Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. 2 Peter 3:18. That's what he did, and that's how he became rock. It's break time.